This is 1-2-1 on BCB 106.6 FM.
So welcome to BCB 106.6 FM. You're listening to 1-2-1 with me, Carol Moss. This is the programme where I talk to the movers and the shakers and the active citizens of Bradford and the district and beyond, find out a little bit about their work, their lives, their hobbies, their interests, and get them to play some of their favourite pieces of music. My guest today is Sophia Bunsey, who's recently been awarded an MBE. So congratulations, Sophia, on that. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the invitation, Caroline.
But the project that you're involved in is the Muslim Women in Prison Project, and you're chief executive of that organisation. So first of all, tell us a little bit about that project and how it started, how you got involved, and what you've managed to achieve.
That project came about in 2012, 2013. I was a community development worker at the time, graduated from, you know, quite newly graduated from university. And as you do in community development, you end up working with different groups. At the time, I was working with young people, heading up a youth project. I was also doing a lot of work with women around engagement, basic education, just more activism within community life for them as well. I noted some trends and patterns in the local community, actually. I think you gather sound bites when you're based in a community organisation. And at that point, I remember hearing and reading stories about Muslim women entering the criminal justice system. And to be quite honest, it was unheard of. And I feel guilty about it now. But even at the time, I'd never thought of Muslim women going to prison. I just think when you think of people who may enter the criminal justice system, you don't automatically think of Muslim women. You know, there's a stereotype that Muslim women are quiet and meek and maybe in some senses beyond any criminal behaviour. Whereas when we looked across at the male counterparts and you looked at Muslim men and we knew criminality there was quite rife. So I think it did really strike me as something that was an invisible area of need. I hadn't looked at it, and my background was research, so that's what I'd studied at university, behavioural science and research, and I think curiosity maybe got the better of me. So I had a conversation with one of my colleagues at the time and said, well, I've never heard of this. Have you ever thought what the plight of these women would have been or what their drivers to go into the CJSR? And he said no, and he said, why don't you go and find out? And it was as simple as that. I thought, right, and I need to maybe go into a prison and research and find out what's happening. So I found myself sending some correspondence over to the neighbouring prisons, HMP Newhall, and asking Grange Prison, saying, look, I've done a desktop research. I just haven't found any information pertaining to Muslim women, not in journals, not on the internet, nowhere really. Women who are very much under the radar, because nobody understood them or nobody wished to understand them. And that made me quite uncomfortable. And I thought, no, this warrants further conversation, maybe because I understood some of the dynamics that would surround those women around maybe family and community dishonour and shame. And the silence would exist because of certain reasons. So, yeah, I went into HMP Newhall and Askham Grange for 15 months. And carried out the first piece of research in the country around Muslim women prisoners and what led them into the criminal justice system. And that in itself was a very sort of dark area of need because there was no previous blueprint to follow. I'd never worked in a prison before. I was quite daunted by the fact that I would have to work in a prison. It's a whole different world within itself. You know, the day-to-day conduct, the roles, the dynamics in there, very different to what they are on the outside.
So what did you find when you went into the prison? Were there any big surprises for you?
I think first of all, the first big surprise was that there weren't many other prison officers or practitioners that looked like me. So there wasn't anybody else that I could relate to. And later on down the line, I learned a lot around lack of representation and the fact that actually the majority of our prison officers come from a certain background. 93% of our prison officers come from a white background, but unfortunately we have a very disproportionate number of Black, Asian and diverse communities in prison. So if you look at the youth estate, 54% of them come from Black, Asian and very diverse backgrounds. So I did learn a lot, and post my time in prison, when I post the first report, that the Lammy review came about, David Lammy's review into disproportionate sentencing and treatment of Black, Asian, minority ethnic people in prison. So yeah, I did learn a lot, I'd say, around race equality, representation, visibility. But also I did learn in the women's estate, pertaining to women all across the board, that actually over 60% of them had previously been victims of domestic violence. Many of them had had very difficult journeys into the CGS. And what I found around Muslim women was this inability to be able to ask for timely help and support when they required it. So many of the women had been victims of, multiple injustices that they felt they couldn't speak about at the time. So whether that was coercion, domestic violence, sexual violence, there was a sense of self-sacrifice amongst the women. They felt that they couldn't ask for help, because if they were asking for help, they would either be betraying family members, betraying their own honour, betraying the family name. So there was a whole chapter in their lives that really wasn't being documented, or there was a lack of community or mainstream-based support that, if it was timely and given at the right time, it really could have perhaps diverted them away from the CGS, and they might have been in a very different situation and position. But I feel like as a Muslim woman and as a South Asian woman, the onus really was there, and I was the right person to do that piece of research, because it helped me to mitigate and untangle this very complex relationship that we have between gender, culture, race and faith. And we know quite often, and I know for a fact, that within my own community sometimes cultural factors play out as opposed to faith. So sometimes we might see a sense of patriarchy playing out or misogyny playing out, and actually that hugely conflicts against the faith values that we must honour, and the faith values that give and afford women their rights as well.
So when you talk to these women, did they talk about the crimes that they had been involved in? Was there some sort of degree of similarity in those crimes, or were they all very different?
I always get asked this question, what is it they're in for? People assume it's something very heinous, and was it murder, or was it, people assume that because they never put Muslim women in that category. And actually a lot of it was petty crime. Some women were in for shoplifting because they felt like they didn't have enough money to buy, I know in some cases, awful, it's heartbreaking, not enough money to buy baby milk. Others had gone down a route of addiction, so shoplifting might have occurred, not paying TV licenses, and then the crimes sort of proceed like that. But there was no one common crime. I think for Muslim women at the moment, it is that they are co-defendants to drug charges. So what we did find was, in the first report that we'd done, that it was something that we called a male hand. So there was a male hand behind the crimes of the women, meaning there was some sort of a connection to a man. In some cases, again, we'd find that there was a sense that some women may have been taking the blame for somebody as well, taking the blame for a man, because there is a notion that if a woman goes into the dock, she's given a lesser charge. So there was this very complex dynamic playing out around honouring the family name, around doing the right thing, and hugely around self-sacrificing, which had to be documented. And post the first report, another two reports we've come up with, and we're now on our fourth report based on a model that we've built in Bradford at the Kidmat Centres, which welcomes women back to the community and really helps them get back on their feet. So we are researching with Leeds Beckett and Sheffield Hallam Universities on Muslim women and desistance, so what stops them reoffending. And on many occasions, we've seen that Muslim women are first-time offenders, they don't always have a culture of going back and reoffending again. It's a lot of the times it's circumstantial, or it's something's happened, life's happened, and they've ended up in prison.
I imagine that at the beginning, establishing trust and getting them to understand what you were doing must have been quite an important thing, because of the shame and the honour issues that you were talking about before. How did you overcome that?
I think there is a very heightened sense of awareness for Muslim women when they are in prison. You know, they are a minority within a minority. They're vastly, hugely outnumbered. They make up about 6% of the population in the female prison estate. I always say with Muslim men, I feel like there's a reference point where they'll always sort of know somebody who has been in prison, or know somebody who may know somebody who's been in prison, so they can exchange notes and say, oh, you know, what goes on inside, or what happens, or how do I sort of navigate this system, or how do I ask for this? Whereas with the women, what we find is they're quite cut off from that type of support. It's very rare that Muslim women would know other women who have committed an offence. They might not know necessarily the pathways, the loopholes. There's a hesitancy to speak, actually, or a hesitancy to be heard sometimes, because there's very real barriers, like language barriers. Not all Muslim women speak English as a first language. Not all Muslim women are familiar with the criminal justice system, or feel they can't ask for their rights. They don't understand mm-hmm. what their rights are, or feel too afraid to ask for them as well. And I think one of the encouraging things was when I went in, and I know post-research, we've had a lot of women say, you know, it was just a breath of fresh air to see somebody who looked like us, who came from our background and came as an independent. So I don't work directly for HMPPS. I come from an independent charity, which gave me that level of neutrality to be able to, I guess, advocate for the women's rights, but also campaign where I had to, and put their needs on the radar and say, this is why I'm here. This is a piece of equality work that I'm doing. And we're here to better services and better outcomes for this group of women.
Okay, let's have a piece of music at this stage. I asked you to choose some music. What's your first piece of music and why have you chosen it?
First piece of music. So you really had me thinking, Carol, and I was having a conversation, and you really enabled me to have a reflection over my life and where it started, and especially all the way to my childhood. So the first piece of music that I've chosen is a piece of music by a boy band called Bross. And the song is When Will I Be Famous? Now, this is a song that my sister used to, you know, blare on the radio when my mum and dad weren't home, by the way. And she had a poster of this boy band, not on her wall, because she might have, you know, my mum might have had something to say about that, but on the inside of her cupboard, on the inside of her wardrobe. And so I'd go in and have a look at it and think, who are these boys with this beautiful blonde hair? And, you know, I'd listen to the song as well. And it was just, I think it might have been the start of the whole boy band movement. And they were just so enthusiastic of when will I be famous? I just still remember that to this day. So I thought, since you've taken me back to my childhood, let me play one of the songs that really sort of, and choose something that really resonates. And I did go back and listen to that song last night. So thank you, Carol.
When will I be famous? Thank you.
Okay, so that was Bros there with When Will I Be Famous? And let's go back a little bit back to the work that you're doing and talk about the reports that you've produced and the outcomes. And what would you say some of the outcomes have been? What has changed? What has been, what are people more aware of? And are things changing inside the prison service for Muslim women in particular?
I think since the first report, especially, and I think I've discussed with you in the past, Carol, that I had a lot of trepidation going in to do that first piece of research as well. Actually, it put me in quite a difficult position because it did raise some questions both within family and within community around the suitability of a Muslim woman going to work within a prison. And in many ways, I guess that was frowned upon as well. And I can't imagine the plight of the women that were in there if I, as a practitioner, was going to be frowned upon. So I think I really had to focus on what my moral values were, as well as my faith values, and what was important, and important, as I've said, from a faith perspective, not a cultural perspective, because we know across any faiths, we are bound to help those that are in difficult positions, those that need our support. I think I had to fight to do and deliver that piece of work. And I'm glad I did. Again, I think the fear around that was perhaps me becoming stigmatized or transference of shame around the subject matter onto me and how that would project. But I quite often think if you do the right thing, I do believe if you do the right thing, God always supports in those matters as well. So since the first research report, which I guess I had to very quietly get my head down with my co-writer and just put across onto paper and write in a very balanced way. And interestingly, my co-writer is a man. So the reason I chose to co-write with a man was because this was a community issue that we were taking on board. I didn't feel like as a woman, it's solely my role and my responsibility to document the needs of Muslim women. So we worked in a faith concept which works under the banner of Ummah, collectivism and community. So we co-wrote together, and actually that really helped us, because I know when we first launched our report, and it was in Huddersfield that we'd launched it, there was a real buy-in from female and male members of the community, from faith leaders, from people across the board. And I genuinely think some people had never thought of Muslim women prisoners. Some were possibly in denial, but on the whole, I just feel nobody had ever thought of the journey of Muslim women prisoners. So they were quite taken aback by it. They were quite surprised that actually these women were going to prison and these were the reasons. But all along, I think it was about us keeping balance. So sometimes you have to say difficult things, but it's how do we say those difficult things? So I think one of the biggest achievements of this project has been the community ownership. And to this day, I can't say we or myself personally has ever incurred any backlash around heading up this project. I think as a Muslim woman, I have to honour my faith, but I also have to honour the women within that and those women that in some aspects require our support or may be vulnerable in different ways. So I think definitely within the Muslim community and the fact that we've embedded a working model at the KidMAT centres. So we've produced solutions and that's what one of our reports was called, community-based solutions. In terms of the CGS, yeah, the work definitely made an impact. I think, again, it had slipped under the radar of the CGS and they hadn't really thought this was a significant number of women. Sometimes you find Muslim women and Roma Gypsy Traveller women are put in the same category. You know, they've got a very similar dynamic and makeup in terms of many of the women are homemakers. They live within a community. There's very real sort of and stringent concepts around gendered roles and what expectations around women. So I feel that the reports that we'd let out had actually, they've left their blueprint and mark on the CGS. The first research report that we'd done actually ended up being given a Butler Trust Award by Her Royal Highness Princess Anne. And the Butler Trust head really looks at best practice within the CGS. It looks at people, projects that are making a real difference, both within policing, prisons and probation. So that for us was a real achievement for us to be picked up as a best practice, and for, you know, somebody as significant as a Royal Highness to say, you know, we hadn't thought of this, and it was undocumented, and it's quite pioneering work. As we've gone on, we found that, you know, again and again, we've had to produce content and knowledge and make recommendations to the prison services, whether that's around diversity of officers, the need around training, better training to be able to work with not just Muslim women, but the wider women from Black backgrounds, traveller backgrounds, foreign national women, who all fall under this very broad banner of BAME women, whose needs are not always understood, or they've just really haven't been given the specialist support that they require to flourish once they come out of the CGS. So we definitely have made an impact. Quite recently, actually, at the end of January, a lot of the specialist providers came together. So a group of people that work with women from ethnic minority backgrounds, and we did develop a 10-point action plan alongside women who have been through the criminal justice, looking at how we better improve policy, how do we reform, how do we better invest in services for Black, Asian and minority ethnic women post-release, but also while they're in custody. So I think we've definitely developed a very good model of work. Interestingly, we've been asked to transfer the model over to work with Muslim men in prison, who are very, very disproportionate in number. So I think that shows a lot of the success that we've had and success that we've had across all systems, you know, policy, research, behind the prison gate and in the community. So it has been a pretty relentless 9-year journey, but well worth it for the reform that's come about as a consequence of it.
Okay, let's have another piece of music. What's your second piece of music?
So my second piece of music is by Tina Turner, and it is a song, a well-known song called What's Love Got to Do With It. So this came about because I think what led me to working with women and girls was the fact that my mum also used to work and volunteer at a women's organisation when we were younger. So we used to spend a lot of our time there. And quite often she'd work with women who were going through difficult life circumstances, had been victims of DV. And at the time, I remember hearing that song played. And I didn't quite know what it meant. I didn't quite know what it was alluding to at the time, having been so young. And then later on, learning about Tina Turner's life and her personal journey. And you know, she was in quite a toxic marriage as well. You know, it did make sense. And I related it to some of the plight of those women as well. So that's why I chose What's Love Got to Do With It.
It's only
Okay, that was Tina Turner, What's Love Got to Do with It? So you mentioned your mum. Let's go back and talk about your early life with your mum and dad. You've mentioned your sister. Tell us a little bit about your family.
My family, I've got two other sisters. I'm the overlooked middle child. So I say to her, you know, I jest with my mum and I say I'm the overlooked middle one, aren't I? But yeah, two sisters. We had a good childhood. So my dad came to the UK. He was in the Navy. So he came over in, I think it was the 70s that he'd come over. And very much sort of integrated into the community in Huddersfield. You know, we were quite known for textiles at the time. Just a thriving town, really, and a very mixed town. You know, it is quite diverse here. I think this is one of the things I love about Huddersfield as well. So, yeah, my mum later came over in the 80s. Once they were married, she joined him. And I think like many women of her generation, she was trying to accustomize herself with the UK. So she'd come from a very warm country where everything was very open. She'd had a huge family network and friends network, and then she came to the UK and had to learn to live indoors, because even in Pakistan you find quite a lot of people sleep outdoors. Everything's outdoors, you know, whether it's farm work, whether it's shopping, markets. And I remember my mum telling us that, oh, I found it really suffocating because I was in a house and you had to lock all the doors and everybody just stays in their respective areas. Nobody really interacts with one another. And I think one of the things with a lot of the new migrants were sometimes they didn't necessarily come to the same area. So they were dotted about everywhere. So going to see a friend or a family member, it might have required a day's planning, or they're further afield. So I think she was very much trying to get accustomed to that and the way that the UK works, and she adjusted quite well. I think once they had children, they managed to make friends in the schoolyard and meet other mums and really adapt. And I remember that South Asian influence still being in the house, or on the radio we'd quite often hear songs played with it, you know, in Punjabi or Urdu. Food was always big within South Asian communities. Food is always a big deal. So, you know, the smell of onion bhajis being made or samosas being made. And I think it was just a very different era. It was a safe time. You know, I look at my nieces and nephews now and they're on the PlayStation, or, you know, they're on the laptops or everything social media. But it was a time and an era where you were face to face. I remember, you know, climbing apple trees and riding bikes until late. And I don't know whether it's just me, Carol, but I just felt like the summers were so much longer. They were so much longer. And, you know, we would be out all hours. So it was simple fun. And I try and tell my nieces and nephews about this in this day and age. And they're like, what do you mean fun climbing trees? Climbing trees isn't fun. How do you mean you did that for hours? And it just won't translate. But you know, they were times when, like I said, everybody left the back door open, everybody was your auntie and uncle, and everybody wanted to feed you. So wonderful, wonderful sort of good memories of growing up and childhood.
Okay, well, that leads us very nicely onto our next piece of music.
So I think I needed a happy song and a song that makes me happy. So it's Pharrell Williams' song, Happy, and I chose this because it always gets me on my feet.
Clap along if you feel like a room without.
So that was Pharrell Williams there, and Happy. So, Sophia Bunsey, you found yourself going to university. Were you the first person in your family to go to university?
I was, yes. I was the first person to go to university. There was a few of us friends that were at college from the same backgrounds that were choosing what we wanted to do. And I know I was really conflicted because I didn't know whether I wanted to go into business or something that was a little bit more psychology based. So I went against the grain and I went for behavioral sciences. And I think to this day, my mum's still trying to figure out what behavioral sciences was about. It's a very unconventional degree. And she kept asking me about pathways and what will it lead to and what sort of a job will you get at the end. And to be honest, Carol, I don't think I was quite sure myself. All I knew was I was very good at psychology, enjoyed it. And I really wanted to do something I enjoyed rather than, you know, the conventional careers that we're told to go into, whether it's, you know, be a doctor or a lawyer or a pharmacist. You know, that pressure was always there to go into a profession which would give you a better outcome or would, you know, communities and families were familiar with. But I guess maybe from a young age, I was pushing against the grain. And went on to study behavioral sciences, and very interesting, a large part of the degree involved research, study of behaviour, study of communities, but also in my second year, I found myself doing a lot of volunteering work as well. So I volunteered at one of the local schools working with young people with behavioural issues, quite disaffected young people. And I think maybe that was my first informal introduction to youth work. I didn't know it at the time, but I really enjoyed that type of work. And my first career had led me onto youth work. I also worked and did some work at the Voluntary Action for Kirklees. And again, learned a lot about community work, community groups, and applying for funding, getting creative projects off the ground. So that held me in good stead later on in my career as well. I did go on and study once again at the university, and I studied youth and community studies, professional studies. I went on and did a management course in that as well. So I found myself there a second time, but really, I guess I played it by ear. So post my first degree, there was a need, there was a project based in the Crossland Moor Ward in Huddersfield, and I thought they were looking for a youth worker, somebody to specifically engage with South Asian girls, because at the time I think the council were having some challenges around the sensitivities of young girls going out to youth clubs, and they also wanted somebody who would support the men's provision as well. And I think that first job working with young people from backgrounds where actually the aspirations were not very high. The ward was in the top 10% of deprived areas in the whole of the UK. And I feel a lot of the young people that we worked with didn't have ambitions. They did largely conform to the lifestyles that the parents were living. And especially with the girls, I felt like there was a lot of gendered expectations and gendered roles and biases that played out for them, in the sense that I know even engaging with them, trying to get them to the youth club was quite difficult. There was times when parents would say, well, she doesn't need to attend an out-of-school provision like a youth club because she'll only get married and have children anyway. We're just waiting for school to finish for her. And it was about me kind of going in there and transforming some of their thinking and saying, well, perhaps you might want to go on to college and you know, I know she will have to work if she's, you know, got a suitor that you've got in mind, especially from abroad. Maybe go into college or go into university might not just broaden her horizons, but enable her to work and earn a better living and a better wage. And that took quite some time. And I think I spent a number of years working in that ward and building trust and trying to influence the thinking. And I think by the time we'd finished, we'd worked with over 300 young people from the ward, and interestingly, on voice and influence work, on youth forum work, on influencing local council structures. And I remember taking out a group of young girls to the Lake District, and by gosh, it took a lot of consent and a lot of permission and a lot of anxious parents, because a lot of the girls hadn't been away from home overnight. But it really changed the rhythm and pace within that community. And when they came back and they're all in one piece and excited, and it was okay for girls to go away, they'd learned so much. At a later date, I remember taking another girls group out to Spain, actually for 7 days, and that was looking at the Muslim Moors in Spain, so somehow relating it to the culture of the people that were there. So looking at the contributions of Muslim Moors in Spain to algebra, geometry, some of the architecture that had been built in Spain, and saying, oh wait, look, it'll relate to faith and it relates to culturally, it relates somewhat as well. So finding those little loopholes where really you were being creative enough to extend the vision and the life opportunities of young women within very conservative communities. And that meant, I guess, me being quite mindful of how I projected my dignity and honour, because I always say the best DBS that's carried out is carried out by parents when you're working with the children. So yeah, they were some of the best years, I think, that of my working life. I really enjoyed, like I said, improving the aspirations of young people, but showing them the possibilities. And as you know, Carol, a lot of my current work as well, I don't just head up the Muslim Women in Prison project. You know, quite recently, I've been very involved in this similar kind of piece of work with Young in COVID.
Let's have another piece of music. What's next?
Next, I think it probably relates to what we've been speaking about, you know, trying to sort of evaluate what you stand for, what some of your morals and values are. So I have chosen M People's Search for the Hero. Quite an uplifting tune, and it's something that really propels me to keep on moving forward.
Okay, so that was M People there with Search for the Hero. You're listening to BCB 106.6 FM. This is One to One. I'm Carol Moss, and I'm talking today to Sophia Fancy. Now, Sophia, you talked about the other things that you're engaged in, and also you've been abroad and worked abroad. Tell us about some of the other things that you've been doing.
Youth works with it. Being my first profession, it's always something that I've held quite close to my heart. And so I've never just solely worked on the Muslim Women in Prison project. I think when you're a community worker, you do everything. And that's how I was trained. You never say no. And you completely embrace everything that comes your way. So young people's work has always been a passion. I know during COVID, I had to really help to bring visibility to young people's plight in Bradford as well. So as you know, Bradford's one of the youngest cities in Europe. But at the time, because I was out working from March onwards, actually, I didn't have that luxury of staying at home, really. We were asked to come back to work at the KidMat centres and help set up food banks, hot food provision, you know, support lines for people that were really struggling within the community, and work on various campaigns. So one of the campaigns I worked on was a nitrous oxide campaign. So you may have seen the silver vials that were scattered everywhere. You know, they were in a way legal highs. So finding them around the centre within communities, had to run a campaign on that. But one of the real issues that came to my attention was just having conversations with young people as I was leaving the centre at night, and them saying, well, nobody really cares about our plight or our journey. This is the most important time in our life and nobody's asking us the impact that COVID's had on us. Everybody thinks from a health perspective we're very resilient, but actually we're not, because there's a real loss of life opportunities and chances that we've incurred. So I decided to make a short film with young people across Bradford about how COVID was impacting them and their lives, and just quietly did that for about 9 months, again at huge risk, because we just didn't know enough about how COVID would transpire. And you know, we did weigh that up, myself and the filmmaker, to say, look, it's a risk and we have to be very aware of that and comply with all the safety measures, but it's worth documenting. So the film went on and it did very well. And again, we had a leadership launch where we did speak to leadership and within the community. The film just went on and won the film, as well as one of the solutions that came out of it, went and won a Good Morning Britain award. And, you know, we were really surprised in December of last year when Frank Bruno came to present us that award as well. So that was really lovely for us. So, yeah, a lot of my work is across communities, you know, even with elderly people. I know every December I host a Christmas dinner for elderly Christians on actual Christmas Day. So those that might otherwise be on their own or may not have family members or friends they can share the day with. So this year was our 10th year. It was our 10th year celebration. And unfortunately, once again, it was a delivery at home. When we didn't have COVID, we would actually transport people to the centre and they would spend a good part of the day with us as well. But unfortunately, the past 2 years, that hasn't been allowed. And also interfaith work is a real passion of mine as well. So that's something that I've always, you know, being very passionate to look at our shared values and how we move together in the spirit of unity and togetherness.
Okay, let's have another piece of music. What's next?
So my next piece of music might just epitomise a lot of the work I do, and it's from Queen Bee. It is Destiny's Child, Independent Women. So Beyoncé would have to be somewhere on this track list, wouldn't she?
Lucy Liu, with my girl Drew, Cameron D and Destiny, Charlie's Angels, come on, come on. Question, tell me what you think about me. I buy my own diamonds and I buy my own rings. Only ring your celly when I'm feeling lonely. When it's all over, please get up and leave. Question, tell me how you feel about this. Try to control me, boy, you get dismissed. Pay my own funnel and I pay my own bills. Always 50-50 in relationships. The shoes on my feet, I love. The clothes I'm wearing.
Okay, so that was Destiny's Child and Independent Woman. I know that you've released another film, which was about the Muslim women prisoners, in addition to the COVID one. What was that film about?
So we've been taking some of the filmmaking at pace. So we're just on our first launch in 2019. We had a film that we'd made with Muslim women prisoners, which was to be kept internally within the CGS and within the women's sector, looking at the particular journey or the plight, because reading something on paper is very different to somebody articulating and the feelings and the emotions and sometimes the passion that comes across on film. You know, it can resonate so much more than just reading a report that might end up being shelved. So that we launched in 2019 and held it very close to us, again, being mindful of the environment that we operate in and whether or not it would would it benefit the mainstream knowing about the experiences of Muslim women going into the CGS? Would there be, it is quite an unsympathetic cause generally, isn't it? When you look at prisoners, not everybody has a level of sympathy or apathy or understanding about that subject matter, and not everybody would like to. So I think that resonated well across the CGS, but it did demonstrate a voice and an invisibility that we hadn't seen before. We're just completing a second film as well at the moment, and I guess weighing up whether it would be worth for that to go public and what the risks involved would be against the benefits of it. And again, it looks at the particular drivers to women who've entered the CGS, at what points they could have been helped to divert them entering the prison system, and what's helped them post as well. So, I mean, a number of our women do go on and really thrive given the right support. So we know this through our provision as well, you know, our portfolio of women, and women who come back as mentors is what I really value. So I know we have a woman who is actually now a probation officer herself. So she has a lived experience, but she's a probation officer. We have another woman who's worked in mental health and is now a mental health manager, and another one that's gone to work in retail, and they all come back as mentors and speak to women that are coming through the CGS to say, it's not a door closed on you. You don't have to be invisible for the rest of your days or try and duck and dive everyone. Because one of the things women really tell us is, you know, sometimes they come out and they feel like they face a second sentence, which is a community sentence. If their crime is documented in a newspaper, it has been public, everybody just finger pointing and saying it's that woman, she's the one that went to prison. So they're held to account on a totally different standard. So the mentors really help in giving us those talks around how they navigated those particular difficulties.
Okay, let's have another piece of music. What's next?
So next is actually a piece of Qawwali music. So it's Sufi music. And it is by a woman that I've always seen as a role model. So she's one of the only female Qawwals that is quite prominent and famous. She's done very well within the scene. And she's always inspired me just by the way that she's held herself and the way she projects. So it's a song by Abida Parveen, a Sufi song called Tere Ishq Na Jaya. So she basically says, for the love of God, it's how she has become so all-embracing of God's love, that she's just become consumed by that love and that mercy that he's shown her.
ਇਸ਼ਕ ਤੇ ਆਤਿਸ਼ ਨੂੰ ਹੀ ਬਰਾਬਰ ਹੋਵਤ ਇਸ਼ਕ ਦਾ ਤਾਉ ਤਿਖੇਰਾ ਹੋਲਾ ਆਤਿਸ਼ ਸਾੜੇ ਕੱਖ ਤੇ ਕਨੇਰਾ ਅਤੇ ਇਸ਼ਕ ਸਾੜੇ ਦਿਲ ਜੇਰਾ ਹੋਲਾ ਆਤਿਸ਼ ਨੂੰ
Okay, so that's Abida Parveen there with Tere Ishq Na Jaya. So, Sophia, you've done lots of work. You've worked a lot in Bradford. I know you feel very strongly about Bradford. Do you think that Bradford has changed in the way it accepts people, the community work that you've done? Do you think there is a development there to receive back people, you know, who have done harm perhaps previously in their lives?
Bradford's a very interesting place, isn't it? There's nowhere quite like it. It's difficult to really put that into words. There's a very electrical energy in Bradford. It's a real melting pot. And I think I've always been invigorated by that energy as well. And in many senses, that's what drew me to Bradford when I was doing my research, because my research was actually largely carried outside of Bradford. It's only my third report that's been developed in Bradford. But reports one and two, you know, came out of Huddersfield, they came out of Nottingham, they came out of different areas. And one of the things that really drew me to Bradford for my third report was just, I guess, some of the community that's based there, their outlook, their willingness to trial. There's a real creativity in Bradford. You know, it is, I read somewhere it's a number one place for startups. You know, for the Muslim community, Bradford is being described as Mecca. It's a go-to place. So whether you watch films like East is East, where there's a real migration towards Bradford and we must go to Bradford. You know, if it's going to work, we always say if it's going to work, it's going to work in Bradford. So it was the best place to trial, and especially trial a resettlement hub for Muslim women who'd be coming back, because we thought if it doesn't work there, it won't work anywhere. And credit to Bradford. Bradford has really sort of accepted and embraced what was there. They've embraced a very difficult discussion around Muslims and criminality, but they've also come up with solutions for that as well. There's one thing talking about something and accepting something, but then to pioneer and come up with solutions and say, okay, we might be up against that, but what are we going to do about it? So I think in just having a visible outward facing hub within the Muslim community, it says a lot about Bradford as well. So yeah, no, I found that you know, Bradford has, whether it's personally myself, whether it's a project, has been a place that has accepted and celebrated and tries to really push the bar and think of new ways of working. Whether that is with prison work, with young people, with anything that I've done, I've always been really encouraged by the willingness to help from community members or those who are in, you know, statutory roles within the city. And they'd really like to get involved. So yeah, I've always had a very positive experience, and especially with the Muslim women, there could have been challenges there, but I feel like including the faith community have been very accepting of this model, and you know, a huge congratulations to Bradford for that as well.
And you found the female leadership of the council particularly helpful. Do you think that's made a major difference?
Yeah, we did discuss this, didn't we? That I was saying, yeah, the fact that there is outward facing female leadership really gives rise and support to that sisterhood and encouraging. You know, I'm somebody that fronts an extremely difficult project that can be construed in so many different ways. And, you know, some people may be hesitant to engage, but I found it with the leadership as well, you know, really encouraging, accepting. And part of that, I believe, is because they found how encouraging my own community is around this project as well. You know, it could be deemed as quite contentious, but actually it's been readily welcomed with open arms, and people are saying, actually go forward and find more solutions. And you know, there's a real level of buy-in to this from people across different sectors. And I think that's the value of having community support and community buy-in, that others, and, you know, reaching and they have that level of respect, knowing what difficult project this has been to navigate, but knowing it's very solution based as well. So I've always found it really encouraging, whether it's, you know, the leader of our council, the CEO, you know, university and health staff, you know, that are in senior leadership positions, enable us to believe actually women of my background can also mobilize to those positions. And there is a level of encouragement and acceptance to do that.
Okay, let's have another piece of music. What's next?
So my next piece of music nicely relates to activism. You know, it's about achieving, it's about freedom. It's Bob Marley's Get Up, Stand Up.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't
Okay, so that was Bob Marley there with Get Up, Stand Up. So, Sophia Bunsey, we're coming towards the end of the programme. So, several years ago, you hosted Royal Highness Prince William and Kate at the Kidmat Centres, and also then appointed an MBE and a Deputy Lieutenant for West Yorkshire, all in 2020. What does that mean to you?
I don't think you can plan for any of those things to happen, Carol. I know when we were asked to host the Royal Highnesses at Kidmat Centres, you know, it was quite a process. It was quite a discreet process as well. And obviously, we know City Hall and Mile Hawes had the civic side and the business side. My biggest, I guess, challenge at the time was I really wanted to include and celebrate and have all communities celebrate that. Which we did, and we did in a very dignified way, and one where young and old came together. And I think it has just snowballed from there, you know. And I feel very blessed, Carol. I feel very blessed that has happened, and it's happened in quick succession. I feel a lot of it as a Muslim. I feel a lot of that has come from some of, you know, the prayers of the women that I support, women that are in very vulnerable positions, because I've said you cannot set yourself up to achieve all of that. And I think it's, you know, it is largely God's blessings, and their positions that I have to honour, and positions that I have to be very dignified in, and bring the best of my community and myself forward in those. So, yeah, very, very humbled, very humbled.
Well, thank you so much for being my guest today here on One to One. It has been hard to pin you down, but it's been well worth it today. Thank you very much. What's going to be your last piece of music?
My last piece of music goes back to some of my university and post-university years, where music from R&B, hip hop, and even garage music was pretty big thing. So my last piece of music is from Craig David featuring Artful Dodger, Rewind.
Thank you very much, Sophia.
Make it.